Grace Point. It is great to see you. Happy Easter. Is this on? I just happy Easter'd you and got nothing. It was just like, no, you decided when you woke up this morning, we're not saying happy Easter to that guy. Well, happy Easter to you anyway. It is so good to see you. So glad you're here. We are going to talk about, thank you. We are going to talk about Easter today, although I think it would be fun sometime for like a pastor to throw a little bit of a curveball and like say, today we're going to talk about the birth of Jesus or something. That might be a little bit fun. But today, before we jump into that, today is not only Easter, but it's also Trans Day of Visibility. Now, if you happen to have been around the internet, you know we have some Christian siblings who are a little bit upset about that, but they're upset about everything, so that's just the case. But here's the thing. Trans Day of Visibility is every year on this day, March 31st. So if anybody's crowding, it would be Easter. And so it is important for us today to say to our trans siblings who are in this room, who are watching online, or those of you in this room who love and support trans folks, that this is a really important day. And that we will continue as a community and as people to stand alongside you, to journey with you, to fight with you, to fight for you, so that you have every single right that you should have as one of God's beloved image bearers and human beings. And what better day than Easter when we're celebrating new life, abundant life, full life. What better day to celebrate our trans siblings also? Are you with me? Yeah. So today we have been on a journey. We have been going through the Gospel of Mark since the first Sunday of January. So I'd like to take the first 45 minutes I have to just walk you through everything in the Gospel of Mark that we've talked about. Let me do just a really quick sort of catching you up. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus enters the picture of history and he announces the good news that he calls the God's kingdom. And we've talked about that maybe for us in the world we find ourselves in, the idea of God's dream for the world sums up sort of what Jesus is doing. That God has a dream for the world, that it would be a place of justice, peace, compassion and goodness for everyone. And Jesus comes announcing that vision, and that vision has led him into a conflict. It led him into a collision with the powers of his day. And at the end of that collision, Jesus goes to Jerusalem, stands up to the powers, and he's executed by the Roman Empire. Now, Mark, the gospel we've been looking at, is not our first witness to the story of Jesus. Did anybody else for a long time just have the assumption that the Bible is in the order it was written? Like that Matthew was first and then Mark, and then that's kind of what I always thought when I was growing up in church. Nobody ever told me different. But actually, Mark is the first gospel. It was the first to be written sometime around the year 70. Before Mark, though, before Mark gives us anything, we have the authentic writings of a guy named Paul. He wrote 7 authentic letters. There are 13 attributed to him, but 7 were actually, for sure, we think, written by Paul. And what Paul doesn't give us is much at all, if anything, in the form of narrative about Jesus. So Paul gives a couple quotes that he says go back to Jesus, and Paul will sort of operate. I just watched the flag out. Oh, Emily's taking it down. I thought the wind just took it. I was like, oh, I have such a different view than the rest of you on what's happening out there. Paul doesn't give us narrative, right? He gives us, he writes letters that are situational, and they're written to specific communities that have specific issues. So people often say, it seems like Paul didn't know or care anything about Jesus as a person. Well, no. If you and I have known each other for a long time and I'm writing you a letter, I'm not going to recap our entire relationship. I'm going to assume it's a body of knowledge. So I think Paul knew stuff about Jesus, just didn't make sense for him to fill up, you know, the version of paper he had that was very expensive and scarce with stuff everybody already knew. And so Mark is the first narrative take on Jesus we get. Mark's the first one to write about the life of Jesus, anything Jesus really said, stories, that sort of thing. And Mark is the first to write about the events that took place in that fateful last week in Jerusalem, where Jesus went to the city and was eventually killed. And the details of that narrative, if you've read Mark 14 on, the details of that narrative just aren't pretty. In those final moments of his life, Jesus was not only betrayed by one of his disciples, but all of his other followers seemed to have abandoned him too. And Mark actually phrases it just very tersely, all of them deserted him and fled. And I think there's a, you know, I don't think everything in the Gospels is historical. I think a lot of it is interpretation. It's stories about Jesus, right? That I think this is almost a historical guarantee. Because if you're Mark, do you really include that? It doesn't paint your people in the best light, does it? All of them deserted him and fled. Everybody who Jesus had with him, his support, his friends, the people who'd been journeying with him for all this time, every single one of them at his arrest completely bailed on him and left him alone. To add insult to injury, one of his disciples, a guy named Peter, who just a couple chapters before had said, Jesus, this is, if I have to die with you, I will never abandon you. And not only did Peter turn tail and run, but when he had the opportunity to change course, somebody said, I think you were with Jesus. And he's like, I don't know the guy. It's, you know, it's sort of what often my teenager will do when I show up to pick him up at school. I don't know this man, right? Hey, I'm glad you could join us. It's good to see you. How you doing? I didn't expect you to be back so soon. Jesus was abandoned by his friends, and now we're laughing. This is great. And he's denied, right? And you just imagine that moment of just everything and everybody you've depended on being totally gone. And finally, the Roman governor Pilate sentenced Jesus to death by crucifixion. The charge against Jesus was not for teaching people to love each other, which is what you often hear. Jesus came and he told people to love each other, and then they killed him for it. The charge was treason. Because he was preaching a different king and a different kingdom in Rome. And in Rome, there is one king, and his name is Caesar. And there is one kingdom, and it is the kingdom of Rome. And any suggestion that somebody else might should be in charge would lead you to death on a Roman cross. And that's what happened to Jesus. All of the disciples fled. And so the reality is we probably don't know very much historically about what happened to Jesus on the cross, other than he died on it. You're thinking, well, the Gospels tell us lots of things, and there are different accounts, and they don't all agree on the crucifixion. The crucifixion in the Gospels are interpretive portraits. What Mark does is Mark takes Psalm 22, and he tells the death of Jesus against the backdrop of Psalm 22. And it's in the Gospel of Mark where Jesus first utters those words of despair from the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus on the cross quotes the scripture, Psalm 22. Eventually, Jesus dies. And his body is taken from the cross. It's wrapped in a linen cloth, and he's placed in a tomb. And if you imagine this like a play, how many of you have been to like a passion play, an Easter play before? If you imagine it like a play, what we would have here is all the lights going down. Everything gets really dark and quiet. And then just imagine softly the lights begin to raise again. And it's no longer Friday, but now it's Sunday morning and it's sunrise. The Sabbath is over and Jesus' disciples have not come back around, but a few of the women disciples have hung around and they watched his death from a distance. We don't know how far, but they were aware. They didn't totally abandon him. And they come to the tomb to do the last thing they could do for this person they loved, which is to give him a somewhat of a more proper burial with spices and those sorts of things. So this is where we are in Mark 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed." Isn't it interesting? Like, it's like telling somebody, like, don't feel a thing, right? Every time some messenger of God shows up in the Bible, people are terrified, and their first thing is like, stop being terrified. And you want to think, like, maybe make a different entrance. Maybe change something on your end to make this a little more easy to deal with. Don't be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there's the place they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you. So they went out and fled from the tomb for terror and amazement. For terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to no one, for they were afraid. And that's the end of the Gospel of Mark. That's how Mark ends. Do you find this odd? Remember, the first narrative, the first time anybody mentions an empty tomb, Paul doesn't seem to know about it or didn't care about it because he doesn't talk about it in that way. But this first idea of this empty tomb, the first idea of someone coming to the tomb and finding the stone rolled away and Jesus MIA, all of that is introduced to us by Mark. But I bet when you think about the Easter story, you probably think about Jesus doing other cool stuff, right? Like, first of all, showing up. Do you notice what we don't get in this story? Like, if this is a play, you expect Jesus in a white baptismal robe to just sort of come out, and we're going to sing He's Alive by Dolly Parton together, and it's going to be, this is Nashville, after all. There's sort of this big climactic moment, and then they pick him up with, like, a zip line, and right, like, you know what I'm talking about? Like, that sort of cool moment. You don't get that in Mark at all. Jesus, they just are told, go to Galilee, go back where it all began, where you first met him, where that figure walking along the beach said, come, follow me, and I'll teach you to fish for people. Go back there, and that's where you'll experience him. But we don't get anything else. This was so troubling to early readers of Mark and scribes who were making copies of Mark that they decided, we've got to fix the ending of Mark. And so growing up, when we had our oversized King James Bibles that everybody would take to church, there is much longer endings. And now what Bible translations do is they usually bracket them, put them in italics as a way of saying, these endings don't seem to be original, right? It seems like they were trying to spice it up a bit. It's sort of what happens when, have you ever watched a movie and you sit like for 3.5 hours or whatever? It's like a really long movie. And you get to the end just as it seems like there's going to be a big climactic resolution and all the things are going to be tied up, all the plot twists and all that are over, and it's going to just be nice, neat, and handed to you. And then the screen just goes black and it says the end and you get nothing resolved. How many of you have had that happen to you and you wanted to throw something at the television, right? Like, we're in a sitcom culture, just wrap it up. And Mark doesn't do that. Mark doesn't just wrap it up. He doesn't put a nice, neat bow on it. He leaves the story open. The women walk away from the tomb saying nothing to no one, for they were afraid. There's also this other thing where throughout the Gospel of Mark, there's this thing that scholars call the messianic secret, where Jesus does something, he performs a healing or something, and then he says to the person, don't tell anybody, and the first thing they do is go run around and tell everybody. And now we're at the tomb, and the young man here is like, go tell everybody, and they're like, nope, not going to do it. And they walk away saying nothing to no one. It's interesting, isn't it? There's a few other things that are interesting about this. First of all, who's the young man? Do you notice it's not an angel? There's a word for that. This is a young man. Now, a young man is mentioned earlier in the Gospels when Jesus is arrested in the garden and he's wearing a linen garment and the soldiers reach out to grab him and he runs away naked, which seems like a weird detail. Like, I want you to know this guy, totally naked. We all thought it was weird. Like, it's weird, man. I think there is something, people have always wondered, what's the young man thing? I think there's almost this symbolism between the young man who, remember, when Mark names a disciple, they're going to do something that he's not proud of. When he doesn't name disciples, he's sort of saying, this is the model. What if this young man represents these disciples who ran away in fear, and yet at some point they come back and they are now announcing that Jesus is alive, right? I think there's some sort of connection with that. What an odd story. What do we do with this story? What does the Easter story in Mark mean? And I want to be very specific. I want to just talk about Mark today. I'm going to reference other stories because I can't help it. But when we're trying to get to the meaning, what is the meaning of this story? Because when we think, it's sort of like when we think about Christmas, what we end up doing is we end up basically having Luke's Christmas story, but then we tack on the wise men. And then the drummer boy shows up and we're like, where are you from? Like, how did we get you? But it's just sort of this amalgamation of stories. We do that with Easter as well, right? So we'll sort of in our mind create a narrative where Jesus is doing other things. And Mark, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't show up. He's like, go back to Galilee and you'll meet him. If you read Matthew, Matthew adds an appearance of Jesus in Galilee on a mountain, because when Matthew copied over 90% of Mark, he got to the end and he went, what was this guy thinking? We got to have Jesus show up. And so you get Jesus on a mountain with his disciples. And you go to John. Jesus apparently has the ability after Easter to phase in and out of rooms, like to walk through walls and doors and such. And then if you get to Luke, not only can Jesus do that, but he eats fish still. And so they keep adding layers upon layers upon layers to the story that Mark began. Because I think in some ways they were uncomfortable, especially as time went on, with the open-endedness of Mark's story. What do we make of this narrative? I want to just talk about a few things. First, I want to talk about this phrase. This young man is seated in the tomb. The women come in and he says to them, oh, you're looking for Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. Isn't it interesting he adds that bit? Oh, you're looking for Jesus, the electrician. You're looking for Jesus, the plumber. No. You're looking for Jesus who was crucified. It's a very specific inclusion there. They mention his mode of death. And I think that actually matters for the Easter story. Imagine Jesus had lived a good long life in the ancient world. And in the ancient world, the average age span was less than 50. Let's say Jesus got to live to 55 or even 60. And he'd spent all those years teaching his disciples and building these lovely communities. And then finally he passes away surrounded by family and friends. And everybody walks away saying, what a great guy. That would have been a good life. I don't think we would be here talking about him. I think what matters is that Jesus had been publicly, legally executed by Rome. It's important, publicly and legally. Jesus violated Roman law and order, and Rome had one specific way of dealing with people who violated law and order. They would kill them. And people like Jesus, who were part of an occupied people, they would crucify. Jesus is known as the crucified one. And I find it interesting, even in other gospels where you have Jesus showing up to his disciples, he still has scars. Like if I were telling the story, I would tell the story where Jesus goes, look, no more scars. It's all better. But that's not how they tell the story. This way Jesus died matters just as much as the fact that he died. And the young man says, he's not here. The Jesus who was crucified has been raised up by God. If you want to get the weight of this, imagine how many of you watched or have ever watched or would publicly even admit to ever having watched a show like Judge Judy or Judge Brown or something like that. How many of you watch it? Like you just need to enjoy someone else's misery for like 20 minutes. And so, and you know what's great about that show is they don't bring somebody in who has like a really simple claim and it's like cut and dry and it's like, hey, they cut down my fruit tree. I want them to replace my fruit tree. The judge is like, okay, replace the fruit tree. We're out of here. It's usually something way out there. And they're going to have arguments and it's going to go back and forth. Imagine this scenario, but like God is the Judge Judy, Judge Brown character. And Jesus is the plaintiff and Caesar is the accused. In this sort of scenario, here's what Easter is saying. Evidence is presented from both sides and God is siding with Jesus over Caesar. Because Caesar said, this is law and order. You violated our empire's law and order, and we will execute you for it. And God, by raising Jesus up, does something else. God sides with Jesus. And I think not only does God side with Jesus, I think in raising Jesus up, God sides with every victim who's ever been victimized in human history. In this moment, we find out that this is a God who is not on the side of the powerful as the ancients all imagined, that if you had power and wealth, then God must be propping up your regime. No. And this is for the Jewish tradition, this goes way back for them. For them, Moses introduced this idea that there is a God who is not on the side of the powerful, but a God who's on the side of the oppressed, a God who cares about the enslaved and wills their liberation. For this tradition, this idea that God is not legitimating the powerful, but God is rescuing the powerless, is deep within it. And Easter is sort of the crescendo of that reality, that God takes a peasant preacher and prophet who was executed unceremoniously by the state. I think we have, if you've ever watched one of those movies they make about Jesus' life and the crucifixion seems like this big grand event, I bet most people would have just looked at it and said, there's another victim of the state. And God has said, no, he's right. His vision of the world, his call for justice, his call for peace, his call for compassion, this is the way the world should be. Easter is a vindication of Jesus and his message. So here's what I think partly what Easter means. It means that the powers and injustices of the world do not have the last word. Easter is a way of pushing back on Caesar and Herod and everybody else from then on and forever who believe that might makes right, that you can kill your way to peace, and that if you just blow up enough stuff, then somehow we'll have peace on earth. And the resurrection of Jesus is saying, no. God sides with those who are victims of empire. Easily applicable in our world even today, would you agree?
Yes.
Yeah, because empires always do the same thing. There is no new playbook from Rome to America or any other empire. We all operate under the same assumptions that we can bully our way into a better world. And by better world, we mean just for us. And not even all of us, just for a very small slice of us. And that's just not how the world gets better. Second, I think that Easter is making a bold claim that Jesus is still with us. Now, here's what I want to say. You come in here today. I bet some of you are here and you're thinking, if I have to believe that a guy who was executed literally bodily in the same body got back up and became alive again and started walking through walls and stuff, then I'm out. That's okay. There's space for that. Now, lots of people say they're not. There's space for that. If you're here today and you think, oh, I really kind of need Jesus to have been back in the body and all that, that's cool too. I'm not going to try to change your mind on that. What we often do is we find these places of disagreement and we want to sit down and argue our sides. And we just end up talking at each other, firmly entrenched in our position. And we actually don't get to the real question, which is, what in the world does this mean? And so can we just be honest? How many of you in this room right now have a time machine? Or at least access to one? Maybe you don't own, maybe you're renting like a tuxedo. Yeah, nobody has a time machine. So here's the point. Nobody can go back in time with their phone and video whatever, if there was a tomb, where the tomb was, how it all worked. Nobody can get that on video. So if you believe Jesus literally, physically, bodily rose from the dead, you got no proof. If you think Jesus didn't, if you think resurrection is more metaphorical, or if you think something spiritual happened, whatever, great. You have no proof. If we sit over here and fight about this, we're not going to get anywhere meaningful. What if we asked, okay, let's just assume both sides of this would say Jesus is still with us, right? However you mean it. What does it mean to say Jesus is still with us? Anybody who's around and doing stuff in the 90s, remember those paintings, those pictures you would hang on the wall, and there would be a bunch of gobbledygook, technical theological term? And if you stared at it long enough and crossed your eyes in just the right way, something would emerge and you would see an image. How many of you remember those? How many of you were ever successful? How many of you never once in your life could see it and it still frustrates you to this day? Oh, thank God. Listen, at 9 a.m., we had just a whole group of overachievers and they were smug. I was the only person in the room, or I was the only honest person in the room. I'm not here to judge. It's up to God, but we know. I was the only person in the room who was like, I never saw. And to this day, if I pass one of those, I'm like triggered by it because I never was able to see it. But I actually think there's something to that in terms of the Easter story. I think the power of Easter is not that it's an objective event, that, and this is the way we tend to talk about it. When I was in college in campus ministry, they had brought somebody in to talk to us about how we could know for sure that Jesus literally bodily rose from the tomb. And it took like 4 hours and there were all sorts of things. And at the end of it, I went, I think I believe that less now that I sat through that. Like it didn't prove anything, because there's no objective way to prove anything. I think the power of Easter is in the fact that it is a subjective story. That just like those blurry image things, you can stand in front of it. And sometimes some people go, I get it, I see it. And some people don't. If Caesar had gone and stood before the tomb, let's just say the tomb's there and it's empty. If Caesar had gone and stood, I'm going to start speaking in tongues. If Caesar had gone and stood before that tomb, I bet you Caesar would have looked into that tomb and just said, oh, it's some sort of hoax. But when Mary Magdalene went and stood before that tomb, and I know I said we shouldn't mix Easter stories, but when it comes to Mary Magdalene, my favorite Mary Magdalene moment is after she finds the tomb empty in John 20 and she runs and tells the disciples and they get in a race and we know for sure who won that race because they told us. And then she walks away, there's no Jesus, and she bumps into Jesus and she thinks he's the gardener and she was right. He's the gardener of new creation in John. And he encounters her and he talks to her and she runs and tells his disciples and she says the most beautiful thing. She says, I have seen the Lord. And I don't know what she saw or what she experienced, but goodness gracious, I believe her. And she stood in front of that tomb and she saw. All the pieces began to move together for her. If you'd brought Pilate over and said, hey, this is where they put the body of that guy you crucified, Pilate would have looked into that tomb and just said, ah, who knows? It's probably in a mass grave somewhere, right? Simon Peter comes to that tomb. And he looks at it, the Jesus he had loved and failed. And he looks into that tomb and he says, I've seen the Lord. I've seen the Lord. I think the power of Easter is that it asks a question of us. Where do you fall on possibility? Where do you fall on something new being born out of something old? Where do you fall on the fact that death exists, but yet somehow life keeps pushing back against it and triumphing over it again and again and again? What if stories don't have to all end badly? What if there's some other way? What if there's something going on in the universe built into the very fabric of creation that we just don't get? What if? Easter is a big what if. And it's inviting us all to stare into it and ask questions about it. I don't know what it was. I really don't. But here's what I do. I really trust in my gut that Jesus is with us. And I trust that the people who had experiences, whatever they were, had experiences that led them to believe that the Jesus they had known, or like in Paul's case, the Jesus he didn't know but was pretty sure he didn't like very much, was somehow still around. I love this quote from Marcus Borg, one of the greatest Jesus scholars of all time. He said, you won't find Jesus in the land of the dead. He is still with us. The powers killed him, but they couldn't stop him. They crucified him and buried him in a rich man's tomb, but imperial execution in a tomb couldn't hold him. And if you've ever heard Borg talk, he had this sing-songy way. In this next line, he would say, he's still loose in the world, which is just the absolute, I can't say it any other way. He's still loose in the world. He's still out there, still here, recruiting people to share his passion for the kingdom of God, a transformed world here and now. It's not over. Amen. The Easter story is essentially arguing that what began in Jesus isn't over, and Jesus is still somehow animating and energizing this body in the world called the church, which sadly far too often works against his vision than with it. But Jesus is still recruiting people to get on this vision of a transformed world of justice and peace where all of God's kids have enough and have a place at the table as their full, true, and beautiful selves. Are you with me? So I think Easter means Jesus is still with us. And then last, I want to focus on this line where the young man tells the women at the tomb, go, tell his disciples and Peter. Now, there's a branch of scholars that think that Mark, the rumor was always that Mark was in Rome with Peter as Peter's translator, and so Mark was written based on Peter's information. We actually don't think that so much anymore. There's actually a branch of scholarship that thinks that Mark actually was pro-Paul and had access to Paul's writings, specifically 1 Corinthians, because the very few narrative things Paul gives us, like a Last Supper and that Jesus was handed over or betrayed, all of that comes from Paul. So people think Mark maybe had access to Paul. And when Paul is giving in 1 Corinthians 15, when he's telling what is Paul's version of Easter, which is, I'm gonna tell you the good news I know, that Christ died, was buried, and then he rose, he was raised up, and then he appeared to Peter, and then also the 12. But if you know the story, isn't Peter one of the 12? And also after, wasn't there 11? Paul doesn't seem to know about that story. Peter, and then the 12. And then Mark comes in at the end here, and he's like, tell his disciples, and Peter. Now, if you know the story, you know that Peter, right before Jesus ended up being betrayed and arrested and executed, Peter was the one saying, no. No, because Jesus is like, all of you are going to bail on me. Peter's like, no, not me. I'm not going to bail on you. If I have to die alongside you, fine, but I will never bail on you. And when those Roman soldiers came into the Garden of Gethsemane, Peter bailed on him. And then shortly after, Jesus had told him, the rooster's going to crow and you're going to have denied me three times. And Peter denies Jesus and then the rooster crows. Can you imagine what it must have felt like for Peter in that moment? The rooster crows and you realize not only did you not stand with him to the death like you claimed, but you actually denied ever even knowing the guy. Can you imagine how those words haunted him on Saturday? Can you imagine how those words felt as they hung over him like a dark cloud? Can you imagine when they went home? Because in my estimation, I think what happened is Jesus gets arrested and most of them run back home to Galilee, right? They get to Galilee as quick as possible. And you remember when they left with Jesus. They'd quit their jobs and they were going to do the kingdom of God thing. And they were celebrating the whole movement of Jesus. And now they come home with their tail between their legs, humiliated. That not only did the kingdom not come in the way they thought it would, but their leader had been executed, humiliated by the state, and they had bailed out on him when he needed their support the most. You ever failed like that? I'll tell you something that lives rent-free in my head, which is that award show when John Travolta was introducing Idina Menzel. Say it with me, Idina Menzel. That's correct, isn't it? The camera zooms in on John Travolta, and he introduces us to the wickedly talented Adele Dazeem. You've got one job, John Travolta. Like, we're not asking you to sing Grease Lightning. You have one job, and it's to say Idina Menzel. And he says Adele Dazeem. Can you imagine when he walks backstage after saying Adele Dazeem? I bet there are moments right now, John Travolta wakes up all these years later and he's going, Adele Dazeem? I said Adele Dazeem. Doesn't even start with the same letters. I said Adele Dazeem. That's a pretty big, like millions of people. I'm still talking about it, frankly, and probably will for quite a long time. What a failure, right? What a failure. So glad I've never done anything remotely. Like, we all have those moments, right? Those moments where you think, I will never show my face again. I am humiliated. If embarrassed is a house, I'm in the 8th floor basement of the embarrassed house, right? Just think about these disciples. And I wonder if this young man in Mark says, tell his disciples and Peter, as a way of saying to these women, you're gonna wanna leave this one out. Because he failed big time. Don't forget, when you're going to tell all the others and you're celebrating that Jesus is with us, that death didn't have the final word in his story, that in this Jesus experience, the power of death has been broken. If Peter's not in the room, go find him. Go find him. And make sure he knows that his failure doesn't have the final word. And I think that's one of the powerful meanings of the Easter story, that our failures do not get the last word in our story. Our Adele Dazeem moments loom large. And if you're like me, you do 9 things well, the one thing that you don't do well, what's the thing you think about all the time? Right? I mean, what is the temptation for athletes? It's not to watch every touchdown or every three-pointer. It's to go back to the myth, the strikeouts, the fumbles, the bricks. That's our human, we just go there. Then Easter comes to us and says, no, 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 no. Those moments are they'll happen. You're human. There's not a problem with being human, by the way. What else would you be? Would you rather be a cricket? People don't like them. No, you're human. It's beautifully, intentionally human. And yet part of being human on this in this experience of humanity is that we have moments. We have our Adele Dazeem moments. We have our moments of failure and our moments of defeat. And not a single one of those moments, no matter how catastrophic, have the final word over who you are and what your story is. And that is the Easter invitation. Will we trust that our failures are not final? I love these words from Frederick Buechner. He says, resurrection means that the worst thing is never the last thing. Resurrection means the worst thing is never the last thing. Because after you lose, you go back to practice. After you fall, you get back up again. After a long, what seems like a long winter, have you seen the trees? I'm not breathing as well because of them, but it's still beautiful to look at. The entirety of creation is in this cycle. And right now, life is pushing back on death as hard as it can, and life will win. Because at the core of everything is an abundant, overflowing goodness and life that is begging us to participate in it. My friends, resurrection for Jesus and resurrection for you and me right here, right now, not just sometime down the road, right here, right now means the worst thing is never the last thing. Are you with me? Amen. Let's pray.